It is a great honor tonight to welcome back to the program, after a long absence, so to speak, E.O. Wilson, the distinguished sociobiologist from Harvard University, who has done a fascinating new work. He has edited the four great books of Charles Darwin, and the total collection in one great volume, with a number of essays by E.O. Wilson punctuating the four separate books of Darwin thereby collected. The overall title is From So Simple a Beginning. With us as well is Robert Richards, an old friend who's been here a number of times, and the last time just a few months ago. He, being professor in the departments of history, philosophy, psychology, and the Committee on the Conceptual and Historical Studies of Science. That's a typical University of Chicago appointment. And he has done two or three major books on Darwin himself. So Darwin is our subject, and evolutionary theory is our subject, and recent controversies over evolutionary theory our subject. But before we get into any of that, I'm going to ask or invite Robert Richards to tell our listeners a bit more about E.O. Wilson than I have already said.
Well, E.O. Wilson certainly is one of the most distinguished, if not the most distinguished, insectologist. I think there's probably not an ant species that Ed Wilson is unfamiliar with.
And a few dozen, or is it more, that he's discovered?
Many that have bear his name, as that's the honorific thing that happens when you discover a new species. He has written numerous books, both technical books meant for the specialist, as well as more popular books that present his ideas and to a larger public. I think that Ed Wilson is probably indeed one of the most distinguished evolutionary biologists going.
And he might properly be designated as the father of, or the founder of, a special scientific interest, which he titled, and the title persists, sociobiology.
He indeed is. In 1975, his book Sociobiology was published. It created, it was a little bit like The Origin of Species, i.e., a little silence first, and then a big roar as a response.
A big
to
bang,
it.
As it were.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of important books, Sigmund Freud, in his introductory lectures to psychoanalysis, points out that there have been three great ideas and three great books that have really shaken up mankind. The first was Copernicus, who disabused us of the notion that our Earth was the center of the universe. That reduced our dignity and our self-inflation. The second was Darwin, who informed us and demonstrated to us that we were not, as a species, independent and somehow significantly different from all the other forms of animal. We were continuous with them. That reduces our dignity the biological realm. And the third great disabuser was, of course, as he asserted in his usual hubristic style, Freud himself, who demonstrated to all mankind that we weren't as mentally competent or as truly intelligent and rational as we thought, but we were governed by the unconscious. Well, he was right about two of those works, though not really, I think, about his own achievement. But let's come then directly to Darwin. How much did he shake up the world at his time? To what degree is the world still reeling from the Darwinian insight?
He really turned a lot of things upside down. He introduced an entirely new way of thinking about biology. He added the other of the second of the two great dimensions of biology. Now, in addition to structural biology, we have evolutionary biology, and the first deals with how the structures work, and the second on why they work, where they came from, and what they mean. But, of course, the reason why, in terms of the impact on human self-image, in my opinion, he exceeds considerably even Copernicus, is that he changed forever our understanding of the nature and the position of humanity.
Theodosius Dobzhansky says, "Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution." You would support that generalization, I presume.
I think that the work done by scientists now on evolution, all of its aspects, have grown so sophisticated, and of course one need not add molecular and cellular biologists as well, and the evidences are so interlocked that you cannot extract evolutionary thinking from any of that without losing a large part of our understanding.
It is reported in the Talmud that the great Rabbi Hillel was asked to give the essence of Judaism while standing on one leg, meaning the central concept, briefly stated. What is, while standing on one leg, the essence of Darwinian evolutionary theory?
Well, that all animal organisms have descended from ancestors in common, and they have done so via a mechanism called natural selection. That is one leg and a couple toes.
The notion that all animals are descended from common earlier ancestors was already around before Darwin, was it not?
Yes, it was, and there was a mechanism for that change in diversification that had been introduced very solidly by Lamarck in France, I think, 1809. He said that evolution proceeded by the transmission of acquired characters. You know, so you acquire certain features by effort, he said, of the organism, which if both sexes have them, are then passed to the offspring. Now, that
the famous example
was,
being the extended neck of the giraffe.
Yes, that's right. The giraffe has a long neck, said Lamarck, because over generations, the giraffes had to stretch their necks on the African savanna to reach higher and higher foliage, and that trait was then passed on. Now, for some reason, maybe Robert Richards can explain it, that didn't have the impact that the Darwinian theory did. And I think the reason the Darwinian theory had the tremendous impact was, first of all, that it was correct, but also because it included the idea of random change, random mutations, we call them today. And the idea that follows from that is that life can diversify autonomously. That is, it does not need any direction, and that it in fact originates from a random process in nature.
But it happens very, 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 add a few more varies, gradually.
Well, that's certainly what Darwin assumed, that it happened very gradually. Just to amplify what Ed just mentioned, that I think Darwin's success was looking at a whole variety of different areas of biology and geology and taking what was empirically known in those disciplines and showing how they're all connected together, something that Lamarck didn't quite pull off, but Darwin did in an exquisite fashion in The Origin of Species, so that he already had, as it were, brought in those who knew the empirical facts, but now he showed how all those areas of geology, biology, were connected one with another. So I think that helped tremendously in convincing his audience.
This wonderful new volume that E.O. Wilson has put together, and which I now have reached for, straining my arm just a bit, the weight being rather significant, is titled From So Simple a Beginning, The Four Great Books of Charles Darwin, edited with introductions by Edward O. Wilson. And the first of those is a great travel volume.
Yes, it's The Voyage of the Beagle, which is worth read just for the sheer pleasure of it.
As
it's
an adventure.
It's one of the greatest travel books of all time, and it's a wonderful read today for two reasons. One, it's the account by a young man of a five-year voyage into the unknown, meticulously and honestly recorded, and it's a coming-of-age story in a part. It's an account of what the Germans called the Wanderjahre, the years of wandering that start so many distinguished careers by bringing the young person out into the open world.
Darwin comes on board a believing, really fundamentalist Christian.
Yes.
And he is disabused of his faith by virtue of what he encounters on the voyage.
Not exactly. If you read his autobiography, mm-hmm. You find that Darwin, oh, let me just finish this about the voyage. So to say, it's to read that book is also like going back in a time machine. Mm-hmm. It really is fascinating to see all these remote parts of the world and some less remote as they were in some detail in the 1830s. But at any rate, Darwin himself describes how he lost his faith. After all, it was strong. He was trained as a minister in Cambridge, and he was very devout, he says, whilst on the early stages of the Beagle. I used to use the Bible to make my moral arguments to, and this to the amusement of my shipmates. But he says gradually he drifted away in stages that were small enough so that he felt no pain as it happened. And finally he says, he makes it clear that what he, that really turned him off completely was what he read in the Bible, that outside of salvation is hell. And he said, if that's true, that means that my brother and my best friends are condemned to hell forever. But and he said, and that is a damnable doctrine. That's what really turned him.
And as he loses the faith on that basis, that opens him, doesn't it, to all the evidence he's encountering about species.
Yeah, just before I try to preempt the historian expert here, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Robert, but my interpretation is that the thought of evolution did not turn him from religion. Leaving his traditional religion freed him intellectually to think widely and very clearly about possibility of evolution.
And Bob Richards did a book some years ago titled Darwin and the Emergence of Evolutionary Theories of Mind and Behavior.
Well, I think you're quite right about Darwin's religious trajectory. He begins as a conventional believing Christian. He goes to Cambridge with the thought of becoming a country parson, which appealed to him. He did it because he disappointed his father. He was at Edinburgh Medical School, and it wasn't something. His father had gone to Edinburgh, his grandfather and his oldest brother, but he wasn't cut out to be a physician. So the next best thing was to be a country parson, which he went to Cambridge with the thought of doing. But he got seduced by reading Alexander von Humboldt, his travels to the New World, and he fell in with John Henslow, a botanist who introduced him in many ways to the great interesting features of the biological world. And his faith was indeed, I think, fairly strong. But as he says, it gradually eked away. Although by the time you get to the origin, it's probably minimally still there. And you find Darwin at least putting some hints in the book that suggests that he says that, you know, in the life may have been breathed into one or several forms at the beginning, although later on, after he's thought about this a great deal, he writes in a letter that he was a coward for having put it that way. He didn't have quite the gumption in order to make a clean break.
But as you both well know, from the beginning there was opposition and indeed even a sense of outrage about Darwin, and it came largely from religionists, some of them not merely Bible-beating fundamentalists, but theologians and people of high intellect, but committed to a religious view, typically and most commonly a Christian view of the essential issues of reality. Persists, or in, one might say has been revived in recent years. We've got some commercials coming. After that, I want to play for you something that Robert Richards has heard already, because he was here the night we talked with someone else who is an advocate of the doctrine of intelligent design. But Ed Wilson hasn't heard this yet. This is as good a spokesman for the intelligent design movement as you might find, perhaps because he got his PhD from Bob Richards at the University of Chicago. We'll hear that and look for some examination, not merely of what he, Paul Nelson, had to say, but rather of what is being said and argued these days. And we'll return to all of that after we pause for this. And Edward Wilson, as I was telling you a moment ago, it was only a few months ago, in fact it was 8/26/05, when we had a debate on these matters between Bob Richards, is with us tonight, and Paul Nelson, who is associated with that institute in Seattle.
The Discovery Institute.
The Discovery Institute, which is the base for advocacy of the intelligent design version of what I think might still properly be called creationism. Here is what Paul Nelson had to say in response to a query from me. And Paul Nelson, if you were to address the Blakeyian question, little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who or what made thee? What would your answer from the vantage point of intelligent design theory be?
Well, I would agree with Bob, of course, that baby lamb came from Ma and Pa lamb. Where I would disagree is I think that as you go back in the history of life, there are striking discontinuities among forms. Discontinuities that seem to be inherent in the nature of living things themselves. That is, they vary a certain amount, but not more than that.
Suddenly something quite new seems to appear. Is
that's
that what
right.
You're saying?
That's right. And that these discontinuities may be places where intelligent design occurred. So I think that while Bob and I would agree about a great many things biological, I would disagree strongly with him that the story of the history of life has been told in the kind of detail that evolution requires.
But if there is an intelligent designer at work, he or it was not at work merely at the very beginning, setting the whole process in motion, as indeed Pope John Paul II seemed to say in an important statement only in the last year or two of his life. Not a God who got the whole thing started and then left it alone, but you're suggesting that some...
An interventionist God.
This is an interventionist rather than an originating God.
Well, that's an interesting question. The interesting thing about intelligent design is that as a general intellectual position, lots of different views are advocated. Some of my colleagues at Discovery Institute, like Mike Behe, a biochemist at Lehigh, argues that all of life was, as it were, there in the first cell, and that unfolded by a designed plan. I find that implausible, but that's Mike's view. So there are lots of possibilities within the general framework of intelligent design. I myself think that, in fact, these discontinuities could not have been bridged by a natural process.
So there we have, he's stressing the striking discontinuities, that is the paleontological gaps in the fossil record. The other basic argument, which he doesn't develop in that quotation, but which he did develop in further conversation, is the argument by design, and that you find structures which are just so complex that they could not possibly have, quote, evolved step by little step over eons. But and the great case in point was the one that was quoted by and often referred to by Darwin himself, namely the eye. Darwin has a number of statements to friends in letters in which he says, the eye really scares me. I don't know how to handle it, and it is an embarrassment, but we have to face it.
Well, I think
it's too complex, and it operates too well to have just evolved. It must have been designed.
Both of those main arguments of the ideas are default arguments. Followed by a non sequitur. That is to say, they depend upon pointing to what is not yet known, and moreover, making the assumption that they will never be known or they are impossible to solve. But you know, biologists and other scientists are in the business of discovering and cracking complex substance systems and looking for gaps and filling them. And if you or others, I mean, if religious believers and theologians were to invest in the stock of intelligent design, it's pretty risky because default arguments can be eliminated. I remember the time, for example, in 1967, when I found the link between the ants and the ancestral wasp. Up till that time, there appeared to be a large gap in the fossil record. such that the earliest ants that were known from the Middle Eocene, about 50 million years ago. And then nothing, and these ants in the Middle Eocene, 50 million years ago, were quite modern in appearance. There had been evolution since then, but mainly they were ants that looked very much like they do today. And creationists always brought up the ants and the missing link. We discovered, we first predicted, a colleague and I, from phylogenetic studies going back, what the ancestral ants probably would look like, and that it would be found probably in the late Mesozoic. And sure enough, it was finally discovered, the link. And then came a whole burst of discoveries in fossil beds that now go back to well over 100 million years, allowing us to trace the origins and early evolution of the ants in some detail. Well, that's the case in point of what's happening widely in paleontology.
Well, now, what were the intermediate species like? How do we know that they are linking species between the ant and the wasp?
Well, they would have, in this case, a combination of traits, some of which are right between the wasp and the ants, mm-hmm. that is intermediate. Some of the traits this particular ant from the Mesozoic had were already ant-like. They'd become strong ant-like, and other traits were still very wasp-like. And we know now we have fossils that fill in a lot of the stages on the intermediacy from what must have been the very earliest social ants to the modern ants.
Have we in more recent years and more recent research found similar links between higher species, between mammalian species, for example?
Well, I think it's been known for a long time, for example, the transition between reptiles and mammals via the therapsids, the mammal-like reptiles. I think that kind of transition, which is an extraordinary transition, has been known for a good long time.
I haven't seen a therapsid in quite a while. What is it?
Well, it's an organism, depending, lived about 250 million years ago.
Yeah.
But through many millions of years, if you look at the skulls, for example, of these organisms, which one of our colleagues at the University of Chicago, Jim Hobson, has drawers full of those mm-hmm. skulls, you can see the gradual transition from a distinctively reptile-like animal to one which is a mammal. But the best examples, more recently, I think, are in our ancestors, our more immediate ancestors. So from Australopithecines, maybe 3.5 million years ago or so, to more advanced creatures, Homo habilis, to various species of Homo erectus, to archaic Homo sapiens, the fossil record there is being ever increased and filled in. To the latest ones, the hobbits that were discovered in Malaya.
Well, but there's an argument now that they're not an intermediate form at all. They are Homo sapiens.
I think the evidence is leaning toward the folks who think that that's a distinct species.
Oh, really?
The latest, yeah. They've now recovered enough specimens of that Homo floresiensis, covering a span of time from something like 70,000 years right up to about 8,000 years. To show that it most likely was a distinct species.
This is a moment where a little further clarification of basic theory would be useful. You've made reference, of course, already to the term natural selection. It's Darwin himself who says that in some ways the phrase of Mr. Herbert Spencer might be even more valuable, the survival of the fittest. Both of those illuminate the nature of the mechanism of transmission of altered features in structures over many, many, many generations. Let's develop that a bit more. In what sense can we still believe, or should we believe, that the changes that do gradually emerge represent survival of the fittest beings or the fittest species?
Well, the original argument by Darwin, which has turned out to be essentially correct, is that genetic variations are constantly being produced anew by what we call mutations today. And this is well known. And now, how would evolution occur? And again, this has been well documented in many, many groups on the micro level and on more than micro level, that among all these variations that occur are some that are able to survive better and reproduce more effectively, or both.
When we speak of survival of the fittest, yeah. One might ask, most fit for what?
The most fit for putting your genes into the next generation. That's why it's called genetic fitness by the biologists.
Most fit for reproducing.
Yeah, that's correct. In other words,
raising progeny.
Yeah, if you die in your teens before you have children, then you have died because of your personal lack of survival. If you live to be 100 but produce no offspring, you have zero genetic fitness because, you didn't reproduce, even though you had longevity.
That's why mules don't reproduce.
Yeah.
We have to make them.
Yeah.
Well, not lately are we making them, but I think the best example, which Darwin himself employs, is artificial selection. So if you look, for example, at dogs, we have some mm-hmm. notion of what the ur-pooch was, probably a wolf in southern China. Mm-hmm. But from that one stock, over maybe 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years of selection.
Merely 6,000 or 8,000 years.
Yeah. You get animals from the Pekingese to the Great Dane.
Uh-huh.
And the morphological differences between those two are extraordinary. And if you found the bones of these animals in, say, 1 million years from now, I'll bet you wouldn't place them in the same species, probably not even in the same genus, looking at, for example, the Pekingese on the one hand and the Great Dane on the other.
One other thing about evolutionary theory that has bothered some people is that it assumes such slight variations across so many, many generations. It seems to go at a creeping, sludgy speed. And there have been some theorists in recent years who've argued that there are also great leaps forward. Steve Gould, whom I used to know, in fact, I was on a committee with him, of another kind of organization. Steve Gould, with Niles Eldridge, develops this notion of punctuated equilibrium, which is essentially, maybe it moves slowly, but it also moves with great leaps forward. Tremendous mutations which produce virtually new species overnight.
Yes. Well, that business of varying rates of evolution have been well known. The mm-hmm. great paleontologist George Simpson even had terminologies to designate those stages in species of rapid versus slow evolution. What was proposed that was not accepted and has been dismissed is that they were so rapid in some cases, or when they slowed down, they were so slow and became stable, static, that this cannot be explained by natural selection. It's just too fast or too slow. And we now know that that's simply not true. You can get, we knew it when it was first proposed, that you can get a complete substitution, for example, of a gene, one gene or many genes, from, say, about a 10% frequency where it's barely visible to 90% with very little natural selection going on in 10 generations. In 10 generations, that's slow in one sense, but if you saw that in the fossil record, and it has occurred a number of times in recorded the fossil record, it would seem to be very fast. But this was never a deviation from evolutionary theory as it was understood by the geneticist and others. It was, I think, a detour in the debate.
A common question that does arise, if you can get changes in, say, 10 generations, is why does Homo sapiens remain discernibly, recognizably the same creature over the few hundred generations of which we've got record?
Well, I suspect that we haven't remained the same. We've changed considerably, so that things like stature are different. One hand, there are new populations of individuals, new subpopulations. And if you're thinking about, the usual...
But they can all breed with one another, and that's one hallmark for species differentiation.
Well, we haven't diversed into different species. That's certainly mm-hmm. true. But
we've altered as a species.
We've altered as a species. Right now, I suspect, for example, one of the great alterations is in earlier generations, before the invention of eyeglasses, for example, mm-hmm. Visual acuity was a lot sharper. Yeah. Now, since selection pressures have been reduced, because you can get eyeglasses right from virtually from the womb. Visual acuity has.
So it isn't survival of the fittest, it's survival of the aided. I've been wearing eyeglasses all my life. If optical science hadn't produced these spectacles,
you would have walked off a cliff, and your genes would not have been perpetuated.
Exactly.
Well, not before you probably had a lot of kids. The point here too is that most of humanity, in what now appears to be supported increasingly by archaeological evidence, the out of Africa scenario appears to be correct.
Mm-hmm.
And most of humanity came from invaders, probably representing a narrow slice of the genetic diversity of the African population some 50,000 years ago, and proceeded, once they broke through into the Eurasian continent, spread swiftly, and all the way in periods of high land emergence and land bridges to Australia. And in that period of time, we have seen genetic differentiation at the racial level very substantially.
As, for example, in pigmentation?
In pigmentation, in facial characteristics, mm-hmm. in some cases physiological characteristics. We're finally beginning to look at this in a relatively objective way because it is an important process in human evolution.
Would one assume that when man first broke out of Africa, he was darker skin color?
We can assume that. Yes, you can.
So our type, that is the Caucasian type, is an evolutionary adaptation to different climatological conditions.
Probably, the first steps toward albinism or pigmentation was less needed.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. The Caucasoids moving north, particularly into Europe, of course, had to deal with the Neanderthals. That mm-hmm. was another species we now see was almost certainly a different species, a quite different Homo species. And it looks as though they lasted until maybe 25,000 years ago. And the reason why they disappeared after a very long period of mm-hmm. time, residence in Europe, almost certainly had to be displacement, that is, extinction at the hands of the
Homo. Well, what rendered them less fit? What do we know about that?
We don't know. They had bigger brains.
They were not capable of speech, I understand. They did not have a descended larynx enabling...
That may be true, but they did have a pretty advanced technology.
Mm-hmm.
That is, in comparison with that of the first Homo sapiens out of Africa. We don't know exactly what did happen, but they lost out.
We pause shortly for some commercials. Let's go back for a moment to the volume from So Simple a Beginning. By the way, what's the origin of the title? Is it a quotation?
That's in the final paragraph of The Origin, in which he says, I can never memorize anything, but I'll paraphrase it. He just said, it is a marvelous concept that from so simple a beginning forms
endless
wonderful
forms.
And beautiful. Hey, can you recite it, Robert?
It's something like endless forms, most beautiful, and I can't remember the last part, but endless forms, most beautiful and most magnificent, have been and are being evolved.
Yes, thank you. The only time that Darwin used, at least up to that time, the word evolve or evolution,
mm-hmm.
the last word in The Origin of Species.
What is to be said about these four volumes in sequence? We've talked some about The Voyage of the Beagle. What is the basic content of On the Origin of Species, as distinguished from the next one in line, The Descent of Man, as distinguished from the final one of the four, The Expression of the Emotions in Man and Animals?
I'll give a very swift run through, and then if Robert wants to continue, he's the expert on the last one. In The Origin of Species, Darwin sets forth with amazing and meticulous detail the theory of evolution by natural selection and the supporting evidence. In The Descent of Man, he drops the other shoe, so to speak, and comes through on what he has promised or foreseen in the origin with the expression, light will be shed on the origin of man, and embraces it very frankly, speaking about humanity having evolved from apes or ape-like forms, probably originating in Africa and so on.
He takes 20 years between the one volume and the next.
Yeah, he's that's a real shocker. Yeah, that's actually 12 years. Mm-hmm. From 59 to 71, and then follows it up quickly with his book, The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals, with an examination of the evolution of instinct.
Yeah, and that's in a way where sociology begins. That is behavior.
And psychology. This is a parental or foundational work for psychology.
Because behavior and behavior patterns are now tracked for their evolutionary, their adaptive value.
Yes.
We might talk more about that right after we pause. I've learned at last to adapt to commercial schedules after some 30 years of doing this thing. And we've got some of those waiting for us, some commercials, that is. And then let's turn to that last of the volumes and for Bob Richards' illumination of that one. After we pause for these words. And we return to E.O. Wilson, who is officially designated as Pellegrino University Professor Emeritus at Harvard University, a legendary entomologist and sociobiologist who has been called the father of biodiversity and by others has been called Darwin's natural heir. He has won two Pulitzer Prizes for his books, one for his book on human nature, the other for his book on the ants. He's the editor of this new collection of Darwin's four great works, From So Simple a Beginning, from which we are drawing and to which we are referring tonight. Our other guest, Robert Richards, is the Morris Fishbein Professor of the History of Science and Medicine at the University of Chicago and is appointed professor in the Departments of History, Philosophy, Psychology, as well as on the Committee on Conceptual and Historical Studies of Science, and himself the author of a number of books about Darwin. Interestingly, E.O. left us at the point where he's asserting that my field, that is psychology, also descends from that fourth of Darwin's volumes. Do you agree?
Well, it certainly ethology does, and behavioral biology really stems from Darwin's own work. Conrad Lawrence, who many years ago wrote an introduction for a new reprint of The Expression of the Emotions, was of that view, that was the foundational book for his own work in ethology. And I think for biological studies of behavior, Darwin's book is nonpareil. It's the foundation, yeah.
And increasingly, we've got now sort of psychological evolutionists, or whatever they call themselves. Your colleague Pinker is one such at Harvard. There are a number of others. Or is Pinker at MIT at the moment, wherever he is?
Harvard.
He is at Harvard. Yeah. Will tell us that a great deal in the human repertoire is not experientially acquired, but is built in. Well, you were saying that yourself, E.O., in earlier work.
Yeah, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, and got in trouble for it. But I think the evidence has been there and growing stronger all along that there's, human behavior is due to an interaction of hardwired sensory responses and patterns of behavior on the one side, to propensities to behavior on the one side, and experience and culture on the other.
Well, look, here we are, three representatives of the species Homo sapiens, none of us kids at this table. We've been interacting over an hour. What in our behavioral record over the last hour reflects that which is hardwired? What reflects that which is experientially based?
Well, I think you're showing us right now by your gestures.
I am gesturing.
You are gesturing, and I suspect that is one of the ways in which we express.
No, but a fine early social psychological study by Efron and Foley on expressive gestural behavior uses as its major samples Jews and Italians in New York, both European-born and American-born, and demonstrates quite different gestural patterns for the Italians and the Jews.
But as a matter of fact, I mean, you are both speaking and you are gesturing, and these are means of communication. And we all do it not precisely in the same way. This is what Ed was just mentioning. There's an interaction between cultural...
You're gesturing right now, too.
I can't express myself without gesturing.
So the fact of gesturing is hardwired, the shape of the gestures.
A lot of it is certainly culturally acquired, but work on human ethology by people like the German ethologist Irenaeus Abel Ibisfeld, who traveled widely in pre-literate societies, recording secretly gestures and facial expressions of people as they lived their daily lives, showed remarkable similarities across the species in all kinds of activities, surprise, shyness, aggressiveness, and so on. Darwin himself wrote widely to correspondents around the world when he was doing his book on the expression to get a catalog, if he could, of such gestures and expressions.
And does Darwin, in fact, successfully demonstrate that there are universal patterns, say, of facial expression, which go with different states of emotion?
Yes, that's correct. There's a lot of variation in the culture, but generally speaking, people can speak through a fairly pretty accurately through a wide array of facial expressions and body posture.
Anger takes one face, love or amusement takes another face, apprehension, fear takes yet another face. Is that the case?
And Darwin actually gives evidence of this through really a kind of innovation, which prior to Darwin, really, there were some earlier anticipations, but through photography. So that you get photographs of faces in different expressive modes, plus an analysis of the musculature behind these expressions and comparing them, for example, with the laughter of a human being with the laughter of a monkey to show continuity. So that Darwin is trying to demonstrate this continuity with
our Would Darwin analysis. Also be called upon to at least offer a good speculative argument as to why those different patterns of facial expression for different emotions have adaptive value, or how they have adaptive value?
Well, you know, now we've entered a realm that is at the frontier of science, and there are no simple answers. The realm is that of what's called gene-culture coevolution. We know that a lot of culture is affected by our genetic patterns, what's hardwired in our brain. And we also know that this genetic hardwiring, to some extent, has evolved while cultures existed. And the way that they have interacted with one another to affect the co-evolution, you know, the evolution of one and the other, is a still largely unexplored area of human behavior. And I await impatiently the entrance of scholars into this field to find out what's going on, one way or the other.
Now, in an earlier work of yours, Ed Wilson, you have confronted a very worrisome, a very disturbing problem. You asserted that human aggressiveness is also hardwired, and we are, as a species, we've got a long history of killing one another, just as certain other lesser or lower species do. And the question is, can we overcome the hardwiring and, in fact, manage to, I'm searching for that great quotation from Locksley Hall of Tennyson, till the battle flag is furled in the parliament of man, till the war drum beats no longer and the battle flag is furled in the parliament of man, the federation of the world. Can we finally stop beating the war drums?
Well, that's the question of questions, isn't it? What's hardwired, I think, is a intense responsiveness that virtually everybody has to intrusion onto their space, their territory, or attempts to humiliate them, when that or subjugate them. When that happens, we get a powerful response, and people tend to anticipate that in ways that cause them to be always on the alert, always on the defensive. And at the tribal level, it has apparently always resulted in war, defense, and the preparation of war and defense. Now, I might be speaking out of line, but my impression is that archaeologists are multiplying evidence now that almost all societies and all cultures are always in war, or preparing for it, or recovering from it. And in other words, it's a fundamental human behavior. So I think we're personally that we're not going to find that parliament of man, thank you, Woodrow Wilson, and manage the planet effectively until we understand that part of human nature more deeply and put it on the table and use it, that understanding, as part of our negotiations.
Thucydides, another theorist as to the nature of man, says in the Peloponnesian Wars that essentially all war comes down to three qualities that men have, or at least qualities that emerge between them when they are organized in collectivities. One is the need for security against aggression from others. The second is the direct pursuit of interest, that is, gaining what you can. And the third, and possibly the most important, is the search for honor or the defense of honor. Does that sound
reasonable? Yeah, that sounds very good. Of course, the sense of honor in war and our eagerness, correct eagerness, to honor our heroes during war is a very important part of the bargaining process that we do to make ourselves altruistic and brave to the extent that it preserves our society.
Now, we will, in a while, be going on to the telephones. I will invite telephone calls at this moment. The number, as ever, is 591-7200, 591-7200. Any question you want to raise, any thought you want to share, we'd be delighted to hear from you. If you're listening to us over the Internet at some greater distance on either coast or in some other country and want to join us, a more feasible way would be via email. The email address is extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word at tribune, tribune.com, or 591-7200. But a few more minutes, if I may, for another simple little question. One thing that seems to differentiate us from even our closest neighbors, who are undoubtedly the high apes, possibly bonobos are our closest neighbor, maybe the chimpanzee is, and they've got some mind, they've got some conscience, they've got an ability to figure things out and use very simple tools, even invent them. But the vast gap between what the ape mind is capable of and what the human mind has achieved and is capable of is, seems to me, a virtually unbridgeable gap. Evolutionary theory has to account for the emergence of full consciousness and of the human mind. How does it do so? Did Darwin achieve anything along those lines?
Well, first of all, Darwin, I don't believe, thought that human intelligence was one of those barriers that he had to overcome. I think most English gentlemen would have assumed that their own hunting dogs were virtually as intelligent, at least, as the Irish, given that they were English. But the real problem was, and the one that Darwin thought he had to bridge, was that of morality. Human beings are moral creatures.
Quite true.
We don't attribute moral virtues to animals. So how do
we
give an
account? Except that we think horses are noble, which suggests that they're moral.
Well, we may think they're noble, but that's a bit of anthropomorphism, probably.
Of course.
But Darwin thought that that was a keen problem that he had to deal with. And so in The Descent of Man, he develops, in some great detail, a theory of human moral judgment, human moral decisions, moral behavior. So
what's the theory?
Well, it's a theory that Ed Wilson probably knows well from his work on ants. When Darwin tried to give an account of what looked like altruistic behavior in bees, for example, in ants, he was stumped for a while, but then he discovered how to give an account of it, namely that a community is selected, a whole community is selected, if some of its members have traits that we think of, and he called altruistic traits.
Greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friend.
For his colony.
For his colony?
Yeah, that's correct. We've just gone through a period, incidentally, in which it was in a build-up of theory which related the kinship to how altruism evolves. In other words, shared genes make us favor relatives. And that positive interaction is what builds up a society. That's been the traditional theory. But now, and I've been involved in this and have published it with a colleague in the Proceedings of the National Academy within the last 2 months, have turned it around, I believe, and back, believe it or not, to group selection. That there may be, and there's a lot of evidence now to turn it around, turn everything upside down, that it may be actually as conceived, somewhat by Darwin, group selection, the competition of groups against solitaires and a group against group, and that this could originate by a relatively small number of genes that have the plasticity in their expression sufficient to create altruistic individuals and even to create in the social insects individuals that are reproductives, take care of reproduction, mm-hmm. and those like the workers, ants that and bees that perplexed Darwin for a while, give up reproduction.
I mean, that would vary across the species, the strength of...
Oh, yes. Yeah. In the earlier stages of evolution of social insects, which we see in the in some bees, not the honeybee, but rather primitive little bees and wasps, we see a lot of variation, and that variation does give us hints as to how it all started.
Now, Bob Richards did a nice and very admirable dodge. I was asking about the evolution of mind. To be sure, moral thought is a function of mind, but our consciousness, our rationality, our higher capability in terms of our linguistic facility, which no other animal species, as far as we know, really has, though they might be able to imitate some of our phonemes. What is the evolutionary account of the emergence of human mind?
Well, again, maybe Robert can give us the answer, but I think that's a great mystery. We're beginning to push at it in several directions. I think the neuroscientists have now entered in an all-out assault. As Darwin once said, you cannot take that citadel by direct assault. You have to do it by all kinds of other investigation. They've begun that, but also we're taking a new look at animal consciousness. Recent papers or books by the late zoologist Don Griffin points to the likelihood of consciousness existing even in honeybees, but it would be more the consciousness of a person driving an automobile that's no longer reflecting on wires going from one place or another, or on the automobile or anything else, but is drawing down on information based on experience and moving toward a goal. That is a kind of primitive consciousness, which may, in fact, have been the first step toward human consciousness.
Of course, another way of going at this problem comes not from biology, evolutionary or otherwise, but from philosophy. And you are familiar with both of those realms of discourse, Bob Richards.
Well, I think philosophers for a very long time have thought that, indeed, human intelligence, human rationality was quite distinctive and very different from that which animals exhibited. But you find even among people like Aristotle was aware that animals had intelligence, and in some cases that intelligence approached that of human beings. He had a favorite among elephants, that elephants displayed a kind of intelligence that was just a little lower than that of human beings. But there's no question that in the history of philosophy that it is usually the case, not universally the case, but usually the case that human beings, the intelligence and consciousness of human beings has been regarded as distinctive. David Hume didn't think so.
Mm-hmm.
And Darwin, interestingly, was a reader of David Hume. So that for David Hume, sense perception, which we share with the animals, is common between us. But also what Hume maintained was that ideas and thought are just fainter copies of sense perception, and that's something that animals are capable of. So in the British empiricist tradition that Darwin himself is a part of, again, this was not a barrier that had to be overcome. That at least he didn't think so. And many of his associates didn't either. Some natural theologians whom he's reading maintained, just as Ed was suggesting, that bees have a kind of rationality. So again, the barrier was not there, at least as far as Darwin was concerned.
But bees don't think about, nor do they discourse with one another about the nature of God.
No, they don't.
Not that we've learned so far.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you one thing about bees that may surprise most listeners, and that is bees can remember the location of up to five places around their nest. They memorize the location, and they can remember when the flowers bloom, what hour of the day the flowers bloom at those five locations.
And there's been work on the language of bees.
Yes, that is...
which isn't the language in our sense.
That's hardwired, but it's nonetheless pretty impressive symbolic language by which the bees dance and provide in the dance a symbolic version of the analog version of where the flowers are, you know, where they can get nectar, and how far away they are.
Whose work is that? I know I read it.
Well, the original, Carl von Frisch, but an immense amount of research has been done on it since then.
We are due for some commercials, and then we'll go on to the phones and to the email. I see some lines are available again on the phone bank. If you've been trying to reach us, make another quick try. We edit or screen, and not everybody gets through. Not everybody makes the cut, but you will if you give us a quick call and have an interesting question or thought that you want to share. 591-7200 is the number. 591-7200 for email, the direct address, extension 720 at tribune.com. And we return to Robert Richards, a professor in the Department of History, Philosophy, Psychology at the University of Chicago, major figure in the history of science, who has spent much of his career looking at the history of biological science and at Darwinism. And E.O. Wilson, who is the Pellegrino University Professor Emeritus at Harvard University, officially your department is zoology, biology?
It's organismic and evolutionary biology.
Organismic and evolutionary biology. And the newest work by E.O. Wilson is... he's in partnership with a fellow named Darwin. It is the edition of the four major works of Darwin, annotated by Edward Wilson, as well as, of course, introductory writing. You've written an introduction overall, and then to each of the chapter, each of the books, and then a concluding essay as well. And they are of the usual high E.O. Wilson quality, I will attest. I might also attest that this book is a very handsome production. You agree, Robert, don't you?
Oh, I certainly do, and they did a wonderful job on it.
And we have the original illustrations from the Darwinian works.
And cleaned up, incidentally, digitally, so they look pretty much the way they must have looked in when they were first printed.
It's a wonderful book. I'm delighted to have it for my own library. 591-7200 is the number as we go to the first call. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yes. I wanted to ask, first of all, about Malthus and Wallace and the relation to Darwin, Malthus and the idea of struggle for existence, and Wallace, who had presented a similar theory to natural selection to Darwin. And of course, we don't know as much about Wallace, so I wondered if I could get a comment about the relation of their thought to perhaps influencing Darwin or not being as important. I have some other burning questions, but I'd be glad if they just do this.
Well, they may have to just sizzle on the fire because we've got lots of callers, so let's process your first interesting question.
Okay.
Wallace, when Darwin was beginning to write The Origin of Species, it was going to be a massive manuscript called On Natural Selection. And he gets a letter from Alfred Russell Wallace, a man whom he had barely known, but Wallace was in Malaya. And Wallace sent him a letter saying, I think I have some ideas about species and their origin. And when Darwin read the essay that Wallace included, his heart almost stopped because he said, it's as if Wallace were looking over my shoulder and copying out of my notebooks. So Darwin thought honor demanded that he give up the project, although his friends convinced him that honor really didn't demand that at all. But he made a précis of the work that he was composing, namely Natural Selection, and it became The Origin of Species. Mm-hmm. So they had a great relationship thereafter. Their views were very close to one another. Wallace always referred to it as Darwin's theory, which irritated Darwin to no end, because he said, it's our theory.
The great sociologist, I'm blocking on his name now, but the fellow who was at Columbia most of his career and worked on the sociology of science.
Robert Merton?
Merton, exactly. Develops the concept of independent parallel invention, suggesting that independent parallel inventions occur when, to use a German term, the Zeitgeist is ready for them, when the world has come to a point or the culture of science has reached the point where the next question will arise, the great question arises and will be answered intelligently by more than one contributor.
In this case, there was a connection, a kind of genetic connection, as it were, because they had both read Malthus, and Malthus provided a kind of clue for Wallace as it did for Darwin. So, but they were both, you know, astute naturalists, and given the kind of experience they both had, these ideas at least were obviously percolating in the heads of both.
Back to the phones. Here's the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
I have two questions. Number one, do any of the guests see any place between first amoeba and us humans that the theory of natural selection would not or may not prove to really be the right explanation? And number two, in explaining perhaps the difference between an Adolf Hitler and a Dietrich Bonhoeffer and how they responded and the area of moral reflection which you were earlier talking about, do you think that the hard science of biological evolution will be able to make that answer? I would tend to think not, but that's my question, and it goes back to the moral reflection and the actions, good and bad, of people.
Well, it's another way of asking, how does one account for the presence of evil in human existence?
Well, on the first question, amoeba to humans, are there gaps? Well, of course there are, but they're closing fast. At the genetic, at the gene level, as well as in the stages that can be elucidated by fossils and also by the study of the living species. On Hitler versus Bonhoeffer, that's just too big a question. Certainly there is what we would all agree to be good and evil in human behavior, and that's a sphere that I don't think Darwinism, as we have been discussing at the core of it as a biological theory, has a lot to add right now.
Yeah, so you could assert, I think it would be a correct assertion, that's not in the realm of biological theory. You need, that's in the realm of some other line of theory. Maybe psychological theory.
Well,
maybe historical analysis.
Well, I think if the question, I'm not quite even sure what the question is, but if the question is how do we account for these two different kinds of human beings, well, I suspect that their own experiences, their own life history gives a large account of this.
But you know, I just got a book yesterday, came in. I've not yet read it, but I'm about to take it home and examine it because the topic fascinates me. The title fascinates me. The title is Nazi Morality. And the argument of the book, well, I just gathered from the flyleaf, it's a Harvard University Press publication. It's a serious work, obviously. But the argument of the book seems to be they had their own morality. They had their own set of super ego ideals which they thought they were serving.
There's another book afoot which gives me pause. It's called From Darwin to Hitler. And it's more than one easy step, but there's the chain is worked out.
Does it touch upon the great embarrassment or the great problem for evolutionary theory, namely that the Nazis used it in justification of their racial extermination policies?
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration.
Is it?
Yes. At least there is.
They believed in the survival of the fittest, and they thought the Aryans were the fittest and had a right. Maybe they're borrowing from Nietzsche just a bit. But
they also didn't think the Aryans were stemming from monkeys either. So I think that there are features of the Darwinian analysis that did not fit well with Nazi propaganda.
Well, this was an extraordinary example of misuse of science, pseudoscience, deliberately adopted, and built upon a framework of mythology. But from their point of view, they had a bizarre mythology, the Nazis did, about the origins of the Aryans and so on. They had pagan rituals to celebrate and so on. But they did have a kind of morality, if you want to call it that, and that was that it was good for the whole species, the human species, if the super race were to dominate, exterminate the Slavs and Jews and other inferior races, populate the world, then of course it would be a better world.
Are they to some degree borrowing from Herbert Spencer in their ideologies?
No. Herbert Spencer, incidentally, was the poor man has been abused a bit. He was actually humanitarian. He was an outspoken proponent of the rights of minorities and developing world people and so on.
Sure.
But however, he did transfer that over to suggest that that in modern society, those who were able to succeed and be genetically more fit through whatever they did, their commercial competitiveness and so on, were continuing a Darwinian process.
I have no doubt that they would have distorted Spencer just as they surely distorted Darwin, but the point that some social historians have made is not that they were carrying through the real meaning of evolutionary theory, but rather they were misusing and abusing it to their own purpose, but that if those theories hadn't been around, they would have been hard-pressed to find a fully develop a fully supportive ideology.
Well, actually, in fact, we find that the neo-Marxist, finally, in the Soviet Union, once the philosophers won the struggle with the eugenicists, eugenics was a very popular idea in
Russia. They go back to Lamarckism in a way.
Well, actually, only in the later stages, in the 1920s.
Lysenko is
essentially. Yeah, let me come to that. I don't want to drone on about this.
But this is fascinating.
In the 20s, an American geneticist named Herbert Mueller, a Nobel Prize winner, had actually helped persuade the Soviet Union that eugenics was a good thing. And they had institutes setting out early to breed the perfect Soviet man. I think, and you can correct me if I'm getting off on this, Robert, but there was a great dispute then between traditional philosophers, Marxist philosophers and these biologists, and the Marxist philosophers won, and they then went to a Lamarckian view, and they also went to a view of the total cultural plasticity of human beings, what we call the blank slate view. So, you know, it doesn't matter what starting point you have in terms of biological thought or pseudo-thought, you can end up to your own tribal purposes by some route or the other.
I've looked into this material in some degree in historical study, and of course the concept of developing the new Soviet man was a guiding ideological imperative. They never developed the new Soviet man, but they settled for trying to develop the new Soviet wheat along Lysenko and along Lamarckian lines. That's what Lysenko was for, and that's what he pushed, and he was tremendously honored and given control over much of Soviet science.
1948, Great Congress presided over by Stalin made Lysenkoism the official scientific theory. And that began to fall apart when the wheat crops designed for northern climates by Lysenko using his method failed miserably.
It's a wonderful chapter. We are very late. I am very late for commercials. My apologies to everybody, including the listeners who are waiting. We'll be directly back to them after this. And directly back to E.O. Wilson and to Robert Richards and to your calls to them. Here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I had a question about evolution, which is, does there have to be geographic separation for one species to evolve into another? In other words, does that pair of butterflies have to get blown over the mountain across the valley and separate and breed separately, or can that happen even while they're breeding with the original population, if that makes any question makes any sense?
Okay, no, that's a straightforward, solid, and sensible question of biological theory. I think the answer, or shall we say the picture we have right now, is that geographical speciation, which you just described, you know, species form when populations are separated by an external barrier, like a mountain range. That is probably the primary, maybe even exclusive way of species formation in some groups, maybe birds, maybe butterflies. But we're becoming aware that there are cases in which species can form if they are, you know, in populations that are divided very locally, maybe in some cases, almost surely in some cases, by what are called host races. That is, one population due to a mutation goes to a host plant to live on it, and so on. And then, of course, there is a case of species of plants. A large percentage of the plant species in the world, the flowering plant, have been formed by almost instantaneously by a doubling or quadrupling of the chromosome content, creating a barrier right away. So it's a very mixed bag, and I think it depends on the particular group and circumstances in which the evolution is occurring.
Okay. All right, thanks to the caller. And if you've been trying to reach us and hitting the busy signal, you would be well advised to try again. We've now got a few lines available. 591-7200. 591-7200. Gentlemen, try this one out. This is by email, very simple and direct. Rob Richards, how do you react to it? How do Charles Darwin's theories affect modern life? It's a broad question.
I think profoundly. It depends on what segment of modern life. Certainly within the sciences, those theories have altered the sciences profoundly. And obviously, from a cultural point of view, Darwin is right now on everyone's lips. There are both large segments of the population who are unwilling or not ready, I suppose, or probably don't know enough about evolutionary theory to be well-disposed toward it and reject it. So from that perspective, Darwin is everywhere. And in 2009, he will be ever more everywhere because it's the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species and the 200th of his birth. So there will be many celebrations and much activity concerning Darwin.
Why have we gone through, in American public life, sort of seizures of Darwin versus religion? One thinks of the Scopes trial. That was what, 1925?
25, yeah.
And is it every decade, every 40 years, I don't know, that we get a controversy about whether evolution should be taught in public schools, and if so, should it be taught alongside something which is more loyal to some sort of quasi-biblical account of creation? And
I would say that...
does this happen in other countries?
Not as nearly as much. The American position, the American response is unique. I think that the reason why it is periodic, and remember, it goes right back to the 1860s, and poor Darwin was never elected to the American, a foreign member of the American Academy of Science. He was also never knighted in England, incidentally.
Mm-hmm.
And there was powerfully disputed within the United States in the 1860s and 70s, and we see it erupting periodically, sort of like an epidemic, this dispute. And the reason why it keeps coming back, and it's as strong as ever, with 51%, the latest CBS poll, of Americans declaring they do not believe that evolution occurred. 34% believe it occurred, but is guided by God. So it's, if anything, it's getting stronger. The reason it keeps coming back is that the division, the gulf opened up by Darwin in 1859, is, in my view, insoluble. I don't think that science and fundamentalist in this one sense, will ever be able to meld their views or come to a wrap.
Well, now, don't you think that Pope John Paul II did, to his own satisfaction, reconcile the two?
He did this. He said the evidence seems strong, that it has to be accepted, but up to, but not including the human mind. So he set off an island, the island that's very vital to religious believers, and said, this far you may come, Mr. Darwin, and the biologists and other scientists, but beyond that line, I don't think you will ever be able to go. That, in a way, is not an agreement or a rapprochement. It is simply a readjusting of the gulf opened by Darwin.
E.O. Wilson, do you not encounter in your own broad field, and this goes to Bob Richards as well, that is in biological science. Do you not encounter persons of faith or at the same time serious contributors to the work?
Well, Robert's had actual direct experience, so I'll turn it over to him.
Well, I certainly you do. You find people who are evolutionary biologists and who are believers of one sort or another. Mm-hmm. I think you don't find, and virtually by definition, you can't find those who are fundamentalist in the sense that they read the Bible in a rather literal fashion. There will be, I think, that kind of gulf that Ed mentions. Interestingly enough, the position that John Paul staked out was first enunciated by someone whom I think is in Ed Wilson's past, namely Eric Vassmann, an entomologist, a Jesuit entomologist, but in his conflict with Ernst Haeckel in the end of the 19th century, he worked out that position, that evolutionary theory is an empirical theory which the evidence will either support or reject, and he himself was convinced that evolution occurred in various insect species, for example, but that man was that Rubicon which could not be crossed, and human mind was distinctively different than animal mind.
With that, I pause for a last round of commercials, then back to the phones. All the lines are filled. There's still room on the email, extension 720, at tribune.com. And in the available time, which is about 9 minutes, we'll work in as many phone calls as we can. 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hello, yeah, Mel?
Yes, sir.
Really enjoy your guest tonight. You guys always have really educational shows. My question was about DNA. Just the amount of DNA that we have and the fact that really 97% of it, I'm looking at a book here, 97% of it is not, doesn't really have any useful purpose. I just wondered if your guests could kind of address how they think DNA complexity came about and why such a large percentage of it seems to be not useful.
That's outside my area of expertise, okay. And I wouldn't want to tackle it because I'm sure I'd make some serious mistake that I would have a hard time living down. If Robert can answer that question, I'd love to hear it.
I think there's actually been a kind of reassessment about the notion of what became known as junk DNA, DNA that wasn't doing anything. But yes, I'm a historian of science and a philosopher of science, not a biologist.
I'm just, if I could just follow up.
Sure.
For you guys, I know you're very convinced in evolution, and I mean, when there's areas like this where there's questions that seem to be difficult, how do you deal with these questions? How do you answer that for yourself? In terms of, you know, does that cause doubts for evolution for you, or what do you do with these kinds of things?
There is so much massive interlocking evidence already available across all of the biological disciplines, from molecular genetics up to the formation of ecosystems. In the fossil record and so on, that it leads, and there are no real exceptions that have been demonstrated, that makes it the total story pretty convincing. There are mysteries to be solved, and that is what science is all about, solving mysteries, including, you know, the explanation of very complex systems.
That being so, how do you respond to these two quotations?
All right.
I hate to make trouble towards the very end of the evening, but still. Fred Hoyle, who was a very distinguished, Sir Fred, I guess, before he died, who was a very distinguished British astronomer and cosmologist, says, the likelihood of the formation of life from inanimate matter is one to a number with 40,000 noughts after it. It is big enough to bury Darwin and the whole theory of evolution. If the beginnings of life were not random, they must therefore have been the product of purposeful intelligence. Now, I'll add another a lesser figure, but still an interesting and important figure in American scientific, or at least public life, C. Everett Koop, the former U.S. Surgeon General, who was quoted as saying, when I make an incision with my scalpel, I see organs of such intricacy that there simply hasn't been enough time for natural evolutionary processes to have developed them.
Well, Hoyle's argument is very familiar. It's often made by mathematicians who really haven't thought the situation through. Mm-hmm. The answer actually is relatively simple, that we've solved with studies of more advanced stages of evolution beyond just the origin of life. And it has to do with stepwise formation of aggregates and early forms of replication, which are entirely within the realm of possibility, combined with selection of these elements, and then on up to more complex systems. This can be and has been duplicated within computers using pure mathematical models, incidentally. And as far as being awestruck by the complexity of organic material,
that's irreducible complexity.
That is irreducible complexity. We're all struck by that. But let me say something about scientists and very quickly, and irreducible complexity. We are in the business of understanding complexity. That's what we do. And if there were any positive evidence for this being irreducible, or any even a theory that could be contrived of how to take supernatural force and transcribe it into or organic process, I'll tell you that there would be a stampede of scientists wanting to work on this. There is no conspiracy, it's a conspiracy of science against such a notion. It's just that it's there is nothing to go on there, and if there ever is, then you will see scientists addressing this. It is simply, at this stage, not science. It's not even close to it.
Robert Richards.
I think one has to emphasize that among evolutionary biologists, there's probably not a more contentious group of scientists. Among evolutionary biologists, there are many, many, many disputes. This is not a dogmatic group of people at all. So they will disagree with one another right and left. What they don't disagree about is the descent of species over long periods of time. What they do dissent about is the mechanisms that produced it, exactly how it occurred, the space, the rate at which it occurred, and so on. So that, I think, is an important thing to...
Here is a question that interests me a good deal. Please go ahead.
I was wondering if you could talk about what we know about Darwin independent of his work. You know, what kind of guy was he? Was he an affable person? Was he humble? Was he a recluse? Was he an oddball? I mean, I'm curious to know what sort of man he was.
Yeah, a very valuable question.
Well, I think when you read Darwin's letters, or his autobiography, which is one of the most charming little books that you could possibly read, this is a guy whom you think maybe you couldn't go out and have a beer with him, but you could at least have a cup of tea with him, and he would entertain you with tales of earthworms and insects and climbing plants. I think he was an adventurous sort. As a young man, he went on, as Ed just earlier mentioned, on this five-year voyage. So he saw the world's the possibilities open up before his eyes, and he gambled. He took a chance against very large odds. But he was a completely affable guy, and most people who met him thought of him exactly in that way.
He had some odd angles to him, though. There's a quote I've trotted out on other occasions, particularly when we were doing something about Shakespeare, in which he is reported to have said, I've been trying to read Shakespeare. There's nothing more disgusting.
Well, but he does, in fact, read Shakespeare. And if you look at the very end of The Expression of the Emotions, he's quoting Shakespeare.
Yeah, curious.
Oh, he quotes Shakespeare for his examples that he has used to think about human emotion. So Shakespeare really wasn't that irrelevant. I just wanted to mention a triviality. I had tea with Darwin's last granddaughter.
Oh, really?
This was at the University of Cambridge. When I spent a month as at Trinity College, and there are Darwin descendants all over the place there, and one of them took me by to see Nora Barlow, who was then 94 years old. She was the one that really removed the expurgated portions of Darwin's autobiography, returned them to the world, and that was. Let me tell you, that was a very interesting experience to sit in the home and have tea, and then see Darwin's portrait on the mantle, along with other family portraits. He was just a family member instead of the icon we have on our wall.
Gentlemen, to revert to Shakespeare, I fear that our revels now are ended. I thank you very much for having joined us tonight.